content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll begin today with The Lonely New Vices of American Life. This was written by Dan Brooks. One minor but arresting fact of U.S. history is the huge amount of alcohol the average American consumed in 1830, 7.1 undiluted gallons a year, the equivalent of 4 shots of 80-proof whiskey every day. Assuming some children wimped out after the first drink, this statistic suggests that large numbers of Jacksonian-era adults were rolling 8 belts deep 7 days a week, with all the attendant implications for social and political life. Imagine what it was like resolving a buggy accident, let alone conducting a presidential election. Much has been said about American supposed national virtues, the mercantile ambition, the Protestant work ethic, the rugged individualism, and the particular character they lend to the United States. But comparatively little has been said about national vices. Give your 19th century plowman a dozen hard ciders, though, and see whether that plays more significant role in his evening than the urge to pull himself up by his bootstraps. Just as personal vices can shape the course of an individual life, so too can national vices influence our collective experience, maybe as much as our virtues, or possibly even more. And these vices are changing. Compared with our forebears, Americans barely drink now, a mere 2.5 gallons per capita in 2022. The more striking change, though, is that in a Gallup poll released in August, only 54% of respondents said they drank at all. The lowest portion since the analytics company started asking the question in 1939. Although doctors surely approve, this downturn is bad news for those of us who use alcohol for its intended purpose, improving the company of others, to say nothing of its off-label uses in dancing, youth sports spectating, karaoke, etc. The decline in drinking coincides with a decline in social activity more broadly. A variety of causes have been blamed for this trend toward isolation, phones chief among them. Maybe the phone theory is correct, and maybe it's not. The forces behind broad national trends are endlessly debatable. At the micro level, however, the influence of different vices become more clear. Consider a night out with friends and the diverging consequences of buying a round of shots versus opening up Instagram. The systemic effects of millions more people looking at their phones and millions fewer getting drunk remain to be seen. These are not only the only changing national vices, however. More Americans are also gambling online, consuming marijuana, and watching pornography than ever before. And these new ascendant vices are likely to shape American life in the 21st century as much as mass day drinking shaped life in the 19th. Nearly half of the U.S. states have legalized recreational marijuana since 2012, a change that seems to be causing a massive rise in the number of Americans who use cannabis. Although evidence does not indicate how many people have given up booze, who have given up booze are taking up weed, the percentage of Americans ages 19 to 30 who reported consuming marijuana within the past year went up by 56% from 2009 to 2023, according to a University of Michigan report. The increase was even higher in the 35 to 50 cohort, whose portion of marijuana uses more than doubled during the same period. These statistics do not include use by minors, which my own unscientific observations suggest has increased approximately 1,000,000% since recreational marijuana became legal in my town in 2023. Again, these numbers don't mean that Americans are turning to marijuana instead of alcohol, but marijuana consumption has gone up at the same time that alcohol consumption has gone down. And the qualitative differences between being high and being drunk translate to differences in social behavior. For instance, alcohol can legally be consumed in bars, where one often meets and even talks to other people. Meanwhile, many states that have legalized recreational marijuana prohibit its use where it is sold, forcing the purchaser to take an additional step in order to get high in company. People can still get high together, obviously, but people who drink in bars are more likely to find themselves socializing whether they mean to or not. Customs surrounding these two drugs differ meaningfully, too. Drinking alone on a regular basis is widely stigmatized as a symptom of alcoholism. The stigma against getting high alone, maybe while you listen to your vinyl copy of GNR Lies and look for that goat you saw in the wood paneling one time, is anecdotally weaker. Is the confluence of decreasing interest in alcohol and increasing interest in marijuana making Americans socialize less? The question cannot reasonably be answered with any certainty. Even if one feels that incidents of people getting riled up and burning down the mill owner's house have gone way down since 1830. But what is the national character, if not a vague feeling? My feeling is that our vices have become more furtive and alone. Consider the massive rise in the most depressing vice I can think of, online gambling. A poll by the Siena College Research Institute found that 48% of men 18 to 49 have an account with an online sports book, an astonishing number that probably has something to do with 39 states having legalized sports betting since 2018. Whereas other forms of gaming require people to sit around the same table, crouch in the same alley, or gather at the same racetrack, online sportsbook users can gamble in total isolation. Say what you will about gambling's ruinous effects on fortune and family, at least it has historically brought people together. The poker craze of the aughts, for example, created an untold number of problem gamblers. It also led them to sit up with one another for hours at a time. The difference between millions of Americans trying to read one another's facial expressions while they reinforce compulsive behavior and millions hunching over their phones to incur a similar risk is not negligible. Perhaps the phrase hunching over their phones is better applied, though, to another lonelier 21st century vice, internet pornography. Some people watch porn together, of course, but one can reasonably assume that most porn is consumed alone. And although erotic images have existed since the dawn of visual representation, internet video pornography and the multi-billion-dollar industry that has developed around it make porn at once more available and more potentially time-consuming than ever before. A single DVD or an issue of Penthouse gets old. The supply of free porn on the web is bottomless. People of different moral persuasions have different perspectives on what constitutes sexual vice and how serious a problem it presents, but at least the analog sexual behaviors that are often frowned upon, such as adultery and promiscuity, require meeting people face-to-face. The combination of erotic and parasocial gratification available on a platform such as OnlyFans makes it possible to spend hours a day on sex without ever touching anyone else, a phenomenon to which the emergence of the term pornosexual attests. I would like to note here that vice persists for a reason. The simplest explanation, favored by both clinicians and moral paragons, is that human beings have evolved poor systems for weighing the immediate pleasures of vice against the long-term costs. So we give in. The psychological mechanism is evident in the serious problems of addiction that can emerge from vices, particularly from alcohol and drug use, but also from gambling and, with some assessments, compulsive consumption of porn. Because these individual problems are well known, vice is often blamed for so-called social problems. Ongoing crises in public health, increased household debt, broken relationships, and other costs, both quantifiable and unaccountable, of people pursuing things that feel good but are ultimately bad for them. At the same time, I hope some readers will agree that although the old vices had net negative effects on some people's lives, their benefits, for those who pursued vice in moderation, went beyond instant gratification to something more valuable. To spend Saturday night at a bar is, in many cases, to spend time with friends and meet new people. To give in to one's carnal urges is to experience increased oxytocin levels in the short term, and in certain cases to find lasting companionship. And gambling at a casino, while it is almost never a smart investment, is at least an excuse to get out of the house, chat, and experience the particular type of empathy that comes from losing alongside strangers. Vice can bring people out of themselves to be with others, even if that means coming together to do what they probably should not. That the new vices are so uniformly solitary suggests that the national character might become more solitary too. This trend is unsettling, but perhaps more alarming is that large numbers of people could become so oblivious to the upside of vice as to decide that it is better pursued alone. I would hate to think that in our collective understanding of sex and gambling and getting wasted, so many Americans would conclude that the endorphins are the only point. Our second story, My Car is Becoming a Brick, by Andrew Mosman. For most of its short life, my Tesla Model 3 has aged beautifully. Since I bought the car in 2019, it has received a number of new features simply by updating its software. My navigation system no longer just directs me to EV chargers along my route. It also shows me in real time how many plugs are free. With the push of a button, I can activate car wash mode, and the Tesla will put itself in neutral and disable the windshield wipers. Some updates are more helpful than others. Thanks to Elon Musk and his middle school humor, I can now play an updated array of fart sounds when an unsuspecting passenger sits down. But Musk is already starting to leave my car behind. In July, Tesla rolled out a version of Musk's AI assistant, Grok, to its vehicles. Even as a chatbot skeptic, I could see the usefulness of asking my car for information without having to fumble with my phone. Alas, at present, Grok runs only on Teslas made in the past few years, which have a more advanced processor to power their infotainment system. My sedan is simply too old. Cars used to be entirely mechanical objects. With hard work and expertise, basically any old vehicle could be restored and operated. On YouTube, you can watch a man drive a 1931 Alvis to McDonald's. But the car itself was stuck in time. If the automaker added a feature to the following year's model, you just didn't get it. Things have changed. My Model 3 has few dials or buttons. Nearly every feature is routed through the giant central touchscreen. It's not just Tesla. Many new cars, and especially electric cars, are now stuffed with software, receiving over-the-air updates to fix bugs, tweak performance, or add new functionality. In other words, your car is a lot like an iPhone. So much so that in the auto industry, describing EVs as smartphones on wheels has become a go-to cliché. This has plenty of advantages, improving navigation, the fart noises, But it also means that your car may become worse because the software is outdated, not because the parts break. Even top-of-the-line phones are destined to become obsolete. Still able to perform the basic functions, like phone calls and texts, but stuck with an old operating system and failing apps. The same struggle is now coming for cars. Software-dependent cars are still new enough that it's unclear how they will age. It's becoming an ethos of the industry that everyone's promising a continually evolving car. Yet we don't yet know how they're going to pull that off, Sean Tucker, a senior editor at Kelley Blue Book, told me. Cars last longer than the technology does. The problem with cars as smartphones on wheels is that these two machines live and die on very different timescales. Many Americans trade in their phone every year, and less than 30% keep an iPhone for longer than 3 years. But the average car on the road is nearly 13 years old. Tesla didn't respond to a request for comment about how its cars age. Automakers have legal requirement to offer free repairs on safety recalls for 15 years after a car was sold to its first owner. Many will issue recalls or updates for cars that are even older than that. But it's a different question when it comes to something like the Grok upgrade, Tucker said. Tesla never promised you Grok. Future updates could be too computationally demanding for a car's hard drive to handle, especially as automakers race to introduce AI and autonomous features. Although missing out on such features wouldn't hurt the driving experience, the apps that incorporate these enhancements might get slow or buggy on cars with older computers. Certain models are destined to age their way out of compatibility with the latest software. It's like trying to put Windows 11 on a PC from 2010, Nick Yekakanian, a senior news editor with the car site Edmunds, told me. It would probably result in something completely unusable. Car companies have already signaled their intent to let older cars become obsolete. Through the 2010s, many vehicles came with 3G connectivity to power a host of in-car features, such as the ability to lock and unlock the car from one's phone. Lapped by superior 4G and 5G, the network shut down in 2022. A lot of 3G cars were still driving around. Subaru upgraded some of its vehicles to the new standard for free, and Tesla let its drivers pay for the better hardware. But when the 3G shutdown came along, companies including Ford, Hyundai, and Audi canceled services for their associated vehicles. Most automakers' response, Tucker said, was, well, you don't have connectivity anymore. So those cars remain drivable, but in some cases, features that relied on the 3G network, including SOS emergency assistance and automatic crash notifications, just stopped working. Wasim Bensaid, Rivian's chief software officer, told me that the EV company is trying to combat the obsolescence issue by giving its computer systems headroom, a coder's way of saying space to grow and add new features. His stated goal is to keep Rivian's updatable for 7 to 10 years. But what about after? The worst-case scenario for today's software-dependent car is the fate of Fisker, which went bankrupt in 2024, leaving no one to send out software patches or fix glitches. Some of the roughly 11,000 Fisker SUVs on the road had software issues that, if not corrected, would eventually made the car useless. Christian Fleming, the president of the Fisker's Owners Association, told me. His group of owners banded together to update Fisker's software. The long-standing auto giants, as well as the established EV startups such as Rivian and Lucid, are in a far better position than Fisker to stick around for the long haul. But IT support will very likely be there for your EV a decade from now. Although it might be, it is still not guaranteed. Most people just want to make the grocery run, whether they have a 2011 Toyota RAV4 or a new six-figure Rivian. A vehicle that routes all of its basic functions through a touchscreen can't afford for the software to get laggy, like an old iPhone. Ben said, promises that decades-old EVs won't turn into pumpkins just because they get old. You'll be able to drive your car in a stable and safe way, he said. But once software-dependent cars stop receiving updates, they will start to get worse. Maybe the navigation system starts to crash, or the Netflix app in your Tesla becomes so buggy that you can't play K-pop Demon Hunters while waiting for the car to recharge. These are the kind of nuisances many smartphone owners know well. Not bad enough to make the device unusable, but annoying enough to make you think about trading it in. Applying the same logic to an automobile threatens to ruin one of the best things about cars, especially electric ones. They endure. Unlike gas-powered cars, which have a conglomeration of timing belts, spark plugs, and mufflers, EVs are simple, with just a few dozen moving parts. That means they can last even longer than traditional vehicles, replacing the battery, electric motors, and a few components when necessary. But as cars become smartphones on wheels, they may not even get that shot at longevity. Today's third story, Venezuela's Grim Prospect, written by Cuico Tora. For many Venezuelans, this is a disorienting moment. For a quarter century, our government has been using the threat of an American military attack to justify more and more authoritarian control over the country. Venezuelans got accustomed to dismissing it all as noise, just a pretext the dictatorship employed to stamp out civil rights. Suddenly, it's not just noise. President Donald Trump is very visibly preparing to do what Nicolas Maduro spent decades swearing the Americans would one day do, use military power to put an end to Venezuela's socialist revolution. The United States has been bombing Venezuelan fast boats, which it alleges are ferrying drugs north, while massing naval forces in the Caribbean. Trump has vacillated between hinting that airstrikes inside Venezuela will be next and saying that he doubts the U.S. will go to war with Venezuela. The administration keeps portraying its actions as part of a counter-narcotics operation, ostensibly the first such operation in history to require the use of an aircraft carrier. And yet the White House doesn't seem to have committed anything like the number of ground troops necessary to invade a country the size of Venezuela. Rather than an old-fashioned ground invasion, then, the U.S. seems to be preparing a bombing campaign from the air. In the absence of a spelled-out plan, we're left to try to infer one. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a Cold War-style anti-communist, describes Maduro as the leader of a designated narco-terrorist organization rather than a government, leading many to conclude that the endgame here is to depose him. Perhaps the idea is to use military pressure to push somebody within the Venezuelan security apparatus to move against Maduro. Even if such a plan succeeds, which is very doubtful, it is likelier to deliver Venezuela to a different style of military dictatorship than it is to bring a return to democracy. Contemplating an imminent American assault on my country of origin is painful, but the Venezuela about to be attacked has little in common with the place where I grew up. The messy, vibrant democracy of my youth is a distant memory, snuffed out by a quarter century of ever harsher authoritarianism. Even the combative Venezuela of 8 years ago, where kids used homemade shields assembled in the streets day after day to battle the dictatorship's goons, is a fading memory. Brutally put down by Maduro's thuggish regime, that protest movement has given way to a mass exodus. Nobody has reliable numbers, but one commonly cited guess is that about a quarter of the population has left in the past decade. A shocking 8 million people. The numbers tell only a part of the story. The rest is about who left. Young, ambitious, high-agency people, many of whom are now delivering meals on bikes in Bogota, Madrid, and Washington, D.C. Mass migration has ripped the demographic heart out of Venezuela. Many of those left are, well, the mirror image of those who emigrated, too young or too old or too sick to face a brutal migrant journey. They stayed behind in an economy in ruins, many of them living off the remittances sent by migrants, under the control of a hyper-corrupt state that is feeding parasitically off the few resources Venezuela still has. We know that a large majority of Venezuelans who remain in the country want to get rid of the government. Because the opposition won last year's presidential election in a landslide, 67% to Maduro's 30%, according to domestic monitors, before Maduro announced himself as the winner. Maduro has outwitted dozens of attempts to depose him over the years. Hanging on to power seems to be the only thing he's relatively competent at. His regime has spent lavishly on a huge Cuban-backed military intelligence apparatus devoted to detecting any sign of disloyalty in the ranks. If and when American bombs start to fall, Venezuela's military counterintelligence system will certainly be put to the test. But it could very well pass that test. Alarmed at the prospect of facing an American bombing campaign, junior officers could well calculate that they're better off pushing Maduro aside than dodging American missiles. The power play, if it came, would likely be bloody and risky, but Rubio's supposed fantasy could conceivably happen. A brave young lieutenant colonel pushes Maduro aside, wrapping himself in the American flag and thanking Trump for liberating the country as he shows Hugo Chavez's successor the door. The maximally stupid outcome is that Trump gets bored of the whole affair and stops the airstrikes after a putsch has been discovered, but before it succeeded. An American assault would then be remembered mostly for helping Maduro identify the next set of tenants for his torture chambers. That's a grim prospect, but then in Venezuela, yesterday's grimmest prospects become tomorrow's headlines with dreadful regularity. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.com.